The hijinks of the finale of Stravinsky's Concerto for Piano and Wind Instruments, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall and live on Radio 3 by Peter Serkin, making his proms debut with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nussen. Peter Serkin almost unwilling to take the applause himself, almost begging the members of the Symphony Orchestra to get to their feet. They're getting a fine reception from the audience here in the hall. Very dapper figure in a pinstripe suit. Plays from music, but with great passion and commitment. Or I should say, and with great passion and commitment. Going off stage, huge thumbs up to the trombones. And they love that. Stravinsky, having taken time out from writing the concerto to get his technique to the point where he could play what he'd written, he gave some 40 performances over 5 years. He's rather plagued with memory lapses himself. He should have used the music. Suddenly become obsessed by ideas that the audience were a collection of dolls, he said, and various things. Anyway, Peter Serkin is back on the platform, now beaming and taking the applause from the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. Extraordinary that this is his proms debut. I remember seeing him playing a two-piano concerto. Could it have been the Mozart? With his father, Rudolf Serkin. Oh, back in the 60s, I would guess. Of course, not only his father, but his grandfather, the violinist and composer Adolf Busch, so a fantastic musical heritage. Has specialised in 20th and 21st century music, but also in Mozart. Back he comes, here with Oliver Nussen. Oliver Nussen bringing the four horns to their feet before raising the rest of the wind, brass, timps and double basses. Well, in 20 minutes' time, Peter Serkin will be back on the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Oliver Nussen to play some very different Stravinsky, which he composed some 35 years later, his Movements for Piano and Orchestra. And that's followed by music written in England at almost exactly the same time, Michael Tippett's Magical Second Symphony. And it's Tippett's words in his letters and writings which take centre stage here on Radio 3 during the interval in the Royal Albert Hall as we head down to the Royal College of Music, where earlier this evening Rana Mitter was in the chair for a Proms Plus literary event.
The Royal College of Music, where we're sitting now, has produced some pretty impressive alumni. But one of the most prominent has to be the man whose second symphony we'll hear in the latter half of tonight's prom, Michael Tippett. Tippett had a stark and rather startlingly clear sense of his own standing in 20th century music. He once wrote, "I'm not as gifted as Ben Britten, but more experienced and capable than Henser," who's also on tonight's programme, of course. The reputation of many of Tippett's works remains strong. A Child of Our Time, Midsummer Marriage, Double Fantasia. But what was it that made this most contradictory of modern musical figures? The gay, conscientious objector who spent time in Wormwood Scrubs and ended up as a somewhat respectable musical knight of the realm. Well, to unpick the man behind the mask of time, that is, and to give a frank assessment of how we should rate him, please welcome the critics Ivan Hewitt and Oliver Soden. Ivan, I've been reading some of Michael Tippett's letters written over many decades to get a flavour of the man. And I have to say, he comes off as someone with a strong, let's say it, egotistical sense of his own centrality.
Yes, I think that's probably putting it mildly. Michael Tippett had this extraordinary intellectual self-confidence from a very early age. In childhood, he tells us he went to his father's bookcase and pulled down volumes on psychoanalysis and Greek philosophy and devoured them. He tells us of the thrill of discovering Kant's Critique of Pure Reason at a pretty you know, tender age. He seems to be somebody who could just override any form of doubt. You know, there was the spectacle of Benjamin Britten, 8 years younger than him, his career steaming ahead of Tippett's, you know, in the 1930s and 40s. One doesn't get much of a sense that Tippett was in any way rattled by this, or, you know, or jealous. Or he was absolutely sure of his own path from the beginning.
And we will want to get to that question of the friendship with Britten, but let's stick with Tippett himself for a moment here, Oliver, because one of the other things you get from these letters is, again, a great frankness. I mean, we've mentioned psychoanalysis. Jung is someone who he was very devoted to, and a strong sense of his own sexuality as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, on the first page of his autobiography, he speaks with absolute candor about his botched circumcision aged 5, and you have to sort of take a deep breath and go with him and stop your toes curling. And the point is that his toes aren't curling, and I really think this candor about not only his sexuality, but his politics and all sorts of beliefs, is not there to embarrass or to shock. It's there through a real sense of honesty, candor, that he really can do nothing other than write what comes into his head, and at the time it comes into his head as well.
One of the curious things for me about reading the autobiography in particular is how extraordinary those dreams are. He gives nearly 100 pages to talking about his dreams, you know, which could be thought to be a very tactless thing. I went to a performance of Laurie Anderson's latest musical extravaganza at the Barbican recently, and one of the great lines in that is, "Never tell anybody your dreams." You know, it's a kind of social faux pas. The wonderful thing about Tippett is he doesn't know what a social faux pas is. You know, he's wonderfully candid at all times.
Yes.
He expresses himself perhaps at greater length than he ought to. And these.
Do you want to give us an example of that, Ivan?
Oh, well,
what kind of faux pas are we talking about here?
Well, the one that sticks in my memory, or two actually that stick in my memory. One is of a game of tennis, where the fourth person, he says, in a game of doubles, is obscure, and he says, "This is exactly as one would expect. The fourth is always obscure, you know." And that, of course, he's referring to that part of Jungian theory, which says, I think this is what it is, where one of the psychological faculties is immersed in the sea of the unconscious and therefore not amenable to consciousness. And so
yes,
that's why one member of the tennis doubles team can't be seen. Tippett's dreams have a wonderful way of fitting in with Jungian symbolism in a way which mine never do. I never have these kind of dreams. You know, I have experienced serious dream envy.
Yes.
You obviously want to spend a bit more time on the couch, Ivan. We can see to that later, perhaps. But I don't want to give the idea, we mustn't give the idea, that this is a man who lived entirely in a world of his own ego, because we mentioned politics. And
yes,
one of the things that comes, it seems to me, from this absolute central core conviction is the politics of pacifism. And one of his greatest moments of personal crisis came in the middle of World War II. As a pacifist, he refused to do military-related work, and he realized that he would end up being sentenced to prison, which he nicknamed Quad, in fact.
Yes.
And I think we can hear a letter to his friend, the musician Francesca Allanson, that talks about this impending imprisonment. And Oliver, I think you can read that for us.
6th of February, 1942, to Francesca Allanson. David, and everyone almost else, is trying to get me to compromise, but I am realizing that mere social work won't replace the music. Only pacifist witness against the whole madness can do so. I am going through a considerable moral crisis, and on the issue will depend whether I can witness outside or inside Quad. I am not frightened by Quad anymore, but my friends are for me. I intend to do that thing which will most clearly show the measure of the world debacle now that my own island has been shattered. It will only be for a time, whatever I decide to do. Mercifully, a portion of my musical self has got out into the big world, and Walter Gerr and others are willing to hold its baby hand while Papa is away from home. I want very much to have the knowledge that things will go on for that side of me by my friends, while I am doing my other enforced job of witness. That will make everything ever so much easier.
Thank you, Oliver. And Ivan, I want to turn to you because, as we know, Tippett, in fact, was sentenced and did serve, I think, 3 months in Wormwood Scrubs as a conscientious objector before he was released. And this really is him walking the walk on pacifism. Is that fair?
Perhaps it is. Yes, he did indeed. And he made sure that his time in Wilbur Scruggs was usefully spent. You know, he organized musical performances, wrote lots of letters, seemed to do an enormous amount of thinking, and seems to have been fortified by the experience.
Were the inhabitants of Wilbur Scruggs interested in modernism?
That I wouldn't like to say.
Well, he certainly taught a daughter of one of his jailers music, but he did describe the orchestra in the prison as light cafe music, and the orchestra had actually been formed by Ivor Novello, who was actually in prison for diddling his petrol coupons to keep his Rolls Royce running during the war.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So he was driving the drive rather than.
I have to say, I wasn't aware that quite so much of Britain's cultural establishment was actually spending time in Chokey during World War II. Things one learns. The letter, Oliver, is to Francesca Allanson, whom he nicknamed Fresca, an immensely close friend and therefore someone to whom he could be very frank about these ideas.
Yes, I mean, I think when it, as far as we can tell, and who are we to say, but as far as one can tell, when it came to the biology and mechanics of sex, Tippett was gay, and he certainly, his two major partners in his life were men. But he does seem to have maintained throughout his life a series of what we might call passionate friendships with women, one of the major ones of whom was Francesca Allanson, as you say, a writer, a musician. They were working together on a monograph about the Irish influence on British folk song. She was also a published novelist, and they were going to get married, according to Tippett, presumably chastely, but they did want a child together. Mm-hmm. But she was in a terrible state by the end of the war, physically, mentally, and in despair, not only at her own sickness, but at the sickness of the world. She threw herself off a bridge into the River Stour at the end of 1945, which, well, the devastation to Tippett was extraordinary. So this was another thing during the war, which was running symbiotically with all his mental trauma, I think.
It's interesting, this ambiguity about his sexuality, and I wonder whether that doesn't apply also to his politics. You know, because one thinks of Tippett as a man of the left, and some of the letters are really quite fiercely anti-capitalist, also anti-imperial. That's one of the strings that struck me about the letters that I hadn't expected to find.
Which he wanted Hitler to win, he says in one of the letters.
Well, I think we need to explain that, because there is actually this letter, I think, in 1936, before the war starts, to the communist. I mean, at that time, Tippett was in the Communist Party, I think, and he wrote to another communist composer, Alan Bush, and said, I hope that Hitler wins. Now, how did he get round that particular statement, Ivan?
Well, I think, like many, you know, fellow travellers of the left, he wised up, and he just seems to have wised up rather quicker than some. You know, one of the reasons he eventually fell out with the Communist Party was that he couldn't stand the orthodox Stalinist line. You know, he was much more of a Trotskyist.
He was a Trotskyist, and
of course, how typical of Tippett to attach himself to the romantic outsider in the communist movement.
But is there a danger we're letting him off the hook a bit too much there? Because to make that statement, even in 1936, even as part of his anti-imperialist stance, to say, I hope Hitler wins, that's a big statement.
Maybe, I mean, this is maybe getting a little close to the knuckle, but one shouldn't forget that Tippett took part in various enterprises to ameliorate the conditions of the working man, particularly in the north of England, a place called Boosbeck in Yorkshire, where he must have fallen in with that rather strange character, Rolf Gardiner, a curious man who had this strange mystical idea that the English, particularly the English, should get back to the soil. He had racist views, not unlike those of Percy Grainger, you know, didn't like the Mediterranean races very much, was very keen on the northern races, later became quite pronouncedly anti-Semitic. And one wonders whether something of that very, that idea of a kind of aristocratic, of a kind of nobility of intellect and art didn't leave a mark on Tippett.
I think so. And of course, Francesca Allanson also owned a very similar establishment. Doolittle's Farm, it was called, just outside East Grinstead in West Sussex. And Tippett, along with lots of other conscientious objectors, went to work on the soil. And that's where Tippett met many of his early lovers and friends. And I think you're absolutely right, yes.
There is that extraordinary moment in is it the autobiography where he puts forward an idea of a vision of what the artist should be, which could have come straight out of the pages of D.H. Lawrence or Yeats. You know,
he was a great reader of Yeats, of course.
Great reader of Yeats.
Obsessive.
I wonder if that actually accounts for some of the cussedness you see there, because I think we've mentioned he was in prison for conscientious objection, and you know, one has to feel a certain sympathy.
But we should go a step further. Not only did he refuse to do military service. He refused to do all the get-out clauses that were offered him.
Well, absolutely, but is this an admirable thing? Because essentially by the end, you know, the British government appeared to be saying, look, we'll find you anything that, you know, sits within this wide spectrum of possibilities. Please don't make us send you to prison. And he appears to have, you know, basically reached the stage by which nothing except what he personally defined as the alternative would do.
Oh, there's an aspect of the martyr in him, and he wrote when he got to prison, I've come home. You know, this was something I think he might have got from his mother, who was also imprisoned as a suffragette for a brief time. So I think there is a bit of the, you know, the person taking upon himself all the great horrors of the world.
Not perhaps the easiest of people to deal with, in other words, particularly if you're a British government fighting the Nazis at the time.
Exactly. Well, Vaughan Williams wrote to him, I don't agree with a single word of your pacifist beliefs, but I do admire you for holding them with the conviction you do, and I don't think anybody could disagree with that.
Britain, we've mentioned more than once, a very long-standing relationship with Tippett. And, Oliver, we have excerpts here from a couple of Tippett's letters to Britain that you've brought together, which date actually from the post-war period, the mid-1950s, about the time of the Second Symphony. Would you read for us?
Yes. My dear Ben, it was heaven to see you again and put hands on you in the flesh. Aldeburgh has had not only a wonderful recuperative effect on me, but it helped to settle my mind in what I want to do. I sigh all the time for your wonderful ease of composition, and what I can steal, I do. There's a lovely phrase from Albert Herring, not my favorite of your works, as you know, which I've got into the most splendid aria of The Midsummer Marriage. It was nice to hear from you just how the old Symphony No. 2 struck you. I'm still very much under the impact of it to myself. It meant a great deal inside. Adrian Bolt proved woefully pusillanimous. But the leader, Paul Beard, was more than inadequate. He'd set out to make trouble and succeeded. There's some long hangover there with regard to my music. You've been much in my mind lately. For better or worse, we too are the most interesting English music has at the moment. Love to you both. Dear, dear Ben. Michael.
Oliver, thank you. And Ivan, he refers there to the first performance of the Second Symphony, which, again, we'll hear in tonight's prom, but that first performance was notoriously an absolute disaster, wasn't it?
It was. It fell apart very, you know, within a few bars, had to be restarted by poor old Adrian Bolt, you know, who must have felt somewhat at sea in this peculiar modern music. He certainly wasn't the first choice of a conductor for the work. There are a number of stories around as to quite why it fell to pieces. It is a challenging work even now. I mean, that violin entry, as we'll hear later, is perilous, and the syncopations and the woodwind lines make it a tricky.
It is.
Wouldn't you say?
I would. And there is, Tippett has a rhythmical way with notes. He called it additive rhythm, which is actually to our ears now, I think, quite simple. But
yes,
to the ears of the 1950s, was deemed distinctly eccentric, not only in the way it sounded, but in the way Tippett noted the music on the page. Paul Beard, who he mentions in this letter, the leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, supposedly, who knows the truth of this, went off and rewrote all the scores, all the string
yes.
parts, renotated them so that the notes would not be barred or grouped over the bar lines. And he did this, so I understand, between rehearsal and concert. I can't believe that was
Yes, and
helpful.
He did it without telling Sir Adrian.
Yes.
That was the problem, which was a mean trick, I think.
Ivan, we mentioned, I mean, this comes from the letter to Britain, and obviously the relationship between them was long and it was close. But that phrase, you know, Tippett's own assessment of himself as not as gifted as Ben keeps coming into my mind. Do you think that was running through his mind as the correspondence with Britain and the relationship with him went on?
Well, I wonder whether what he really meant was, I may not be as gifted as you in that way, but I have this other thing.
Oh,
you know?
Really?
What do you think the other thing is?
I think the other thing is that, to go back to where we started, really, that extraordinary intellectual self-confidence which allows him to build an imaginative world, as far as one can tell, unaided. In a way, they're polar opposites. You know, Britain was so perfectly secure and confident musically, but needed guidance outside music, I think. You know,
yes.
we know that he leant very heavily on Auden to form his literary tastes. Tippett seems to have discovered everything for himself.
I think it's crude, but I think a Mozart-Beethoven division is not unhelpful.
Yes.
I mean, in that Britain has this...
Which one is which?
Exactly. In that Britain, it was Tippett who called Britain divinely gifted, and Britain always has this Mozartian sense of taking dictation from God, and it all just comes out on the page beautifully formed. With Tippett, you have this absolutely Beethovenian sense of struggle. Every single note on the page takes days of...
Let me look you in the eyes, Oliver, and say, am I wrong for thinking that Britain is a greater composer than Tippett?
Yes, very much so, I believe.
I think that question of different types of creativity, though, leads us to the next reading, which is from the script Tippett wrote for a film that he'd made in collaboration with the director Misha Scorer, called Poets in a Barren Age. And it was part of a BBC television series called One Pair of Eyes, which went out in 1972. Oliver.
I've been writing music for 40 years. During those years, there have been huge and world-shattering events in which I have been inevitably caught up. Whether society has felt music valuable or needful, I have gone on writing because I must. And I know that my true function within a society which embraces all of us is to continue a tradition fundamental to our civilization, which goes back into prehistory and will go forward into the unknown future. This tradition is to create images from the depths of the imagination and to give them form, whether visual, intellectual, or musical. For it is only through images that the inner world communicates at all. Images of the past, shapes of the future. Images of vigor for a decadent period. Images of calm for one too violent. Images of reconciliation for worlds torn by division. And in an age of mediocrity and shattered dreams, images of abounding, generous, exuberant beauty.
Oliver, what you just read to us is an immensely articulate and, of course, verbalized expression of Tippett's artistic vision.
Yes.
I mean, would the accusation, perhaps unfair, be that for him, by the stage, the words are doing too much and the music not enough?
Oh, God, he'd hate to hear you say that, I'm sure. Do you mean the words that he's written here on the page?
The sense of using the words to try and make a case for the music rather than letting the music do it itself.
Tippett was certainly someone who wanted to explain himself, and thousands and thousands of letters and 3 volumes of essays and an autobiography testify to that. I mean, when it comes to writing on music, I don't think it gets better than what I've just read out, personally.
Also, isn't part of the problem that he feels he's up against it in a way, that... there's another, if I may, just drop in another little reading which shows that despite his great generosity, Tippett is remarkable for the fact that he, on the whole, doesn't take cudgels to his audience. You know, he's different to the modernist composers, and he does not despise his public. But there is one moment in an essay he wrote on composer and his public where he says, when he's discussing the question, why was it that Bartok fared so badly later in life? And he says, surely the matter is that the very big public masses together in a kind of death passion mediocrity. And that this blanket of mediocrity, whether communist or capitalist, is deeply offended by any living passion of the unusual, the rare, the rich, the exuberant, the heroic, and the aristocratic. So he's recycling that list, but now saying, the reason I have to fight for it is that they, the masses, don't like it or are hostile to it. And I must admit, when I read that, I have a slight moment of disappointment. I think, oh dear, Tippett's slipping into that language of the masses, which the fearful right-wingers used to slip into, you know, people like Yeats and...
I think partly what that reading draws up, and perhaps this is another important difference between him and Britain, Tippett did, I think he cared very deeply about his audience and what his music would do, but he did not write for specific occasions, he did not write for specific people, he did not do particularly that Britain thing of writing Gloriana for a Jubilee or a Sinfonia de Requiem for the Japanese emperors or whatever he did. He wrote because he had to write, and while the audience is important, what is more important is writing what you have to write without any... having to pander in any way to any particular commission. He wrote The Midsummer Marriage, his first opera, which is 700 pages, a full score, 4 hours. No commission, no fee, no promise of a performance. He wrote music because he had to.
I'm afraid that time, that old Tippett obsession, has defeated us once more. But many thanks to my two guests tonight, Oliver Soden and Ivan Hewitt.
And that was Rana Mitter. The producer was Laura Thomas. And if you're coming to a prom, have a look to see whether you might like to go to the Proms Plus event at the Royal College of Music beforehand. There's one every day. Welcome back to a very warm Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, for the second half of tonight's BBC Prom. Live, of course, as is every prom here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. And tonight, the home team, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, is being conducted by its artist in association, Oliver Nusson. They end with the first of seven works by Michael Tippett being performed at this year's proms, the joyful, tender, fantastical Second Symphony. Before that, though, we hear again from pianist Peter Serkin, who's making his proms debut this evening. After the concerto for piano and wind instruments at the end of the first half, he now tackles some very different Stravinsky, music he composed some 35 years after the concerto. He wrote his movements for piano and orchestra at the end of the 1950s and said the five short movements are related more by tempo than by differences of timbre, mood, character. In a work only 8 minutes long, construction must replace contrast. The movements explore new harmonic regions, some of them more complex than in any of my previous music. I'm amazed at this myself. Oliver Nusson.
I remember when Movements for Piano and Orchestra first came out, I believe it was written in 58, 59. It sounded just so sort of off the wall and modern music-y. I mean, people who like Stravinsky's other music, the earlier music, said, oh my God, he's really gone too far this time, or he's really gone off the rails. Because writing 12-tone music is one thing, which he's been doing for a few years then, but actually then this extreme fragmentation of the language, which is still striking today even. When I bought the recording and listened to it, you know, several hundred times, one started to feel that those notes were set in stone, that there was something absolutely right about the placement of every sound. And that effect remains with me to this day. This is, what's that, for nearly 50 years later. But it's a piece I love very much, and Peter has probably played it more than any other pianist alive or dead, and I've probably conducted it more than any other conductor. I mean, it's a little obsession of mine, this piece.
Oliver Nusson. Well, the result is an intense and very compressed work with the piano writing full of wide leaps. Stravinsky involves a large chamber orchestra, which includes harp and celesta, but only uses it in constantly changing small ensembles with the solo piano. In fact, he was going to call the piece Concerto for Piano and Groups of Instruments. And the last thing Stravinsky did to the piece was to add short interludes without piano between the movements. All's ready? Guest leader Jan Fischer played the piano to tumultuous applause and grinned broadly. But he's now back sitting, waiting as we are for Peter Serkin and Oliver Nusson. And here they come. Joining a chamber-sized BBC Symphony Orchestra on the Royal Albert Hall stage to perform Stravinsky's Movements. Stravinsky at his tersest, his most glittering in his movements for piano and orchestra, played to open the second half of this BBC prom by Peter Serkin with the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by Oliver Nussen. I heard a little clip of Stravinsky in French praising the BBC Symphony Orchestra back in 1934. He said, "Working with them always gives me much joy. The musicians achieve a close rapport with the music." Well, that hasn't changed in the last nearly 80 years, I'd say. As for Peter Serkin, well, he's busy teaching and playing. Just given another thumbs up to the trombones, obviously feels a close affinity with them. He's going to be playing the Dvorak Piano Quintet with the Orion Quartet back home in Massachusetts shortly. And then that Stravinsky concerto we heard before the interval for piano and wind with the Boston Symphony Orchestra at the Tanglewood Festival. Back he comes, the dapper figure, warmly welcomed back and applauded by orchestra as well as audience. Actually, it's a very tight squeeze to get round past the music stand and the conductor's rostrum to get to the piano, which is where he's now got. I think we might get a little more. magical how intimate the Royal Albert Hall can become, isn't it? Lovely to watch the slow smiles appearing on the faces of the orchestra as they realised what he was playing. It's a charming little early song by Toru Takemitsu called I Just Sing. Takemitsu, of course, has written music, not that, but has written music for Peter Serkin, who returns once more, drew us all in with that performance. I think now he would say he's enjoyed his first time at the BBC Proms. Well, before we get to the final work on the programme, Tippett's Second Symphony, the piano has to be moved away, of course, which means the musicians of the BBC Symphony Orchestra are gathered just off stage, waiting for the word to go back on. And among them, I hope, is our roving reporter, Georgia Mann. Georgia.
I am indeed amongst them, Martin. I'm backstage just with the remainder of the orchestra who weren't on there with the sort of chamber formation during the Stravinsky, and there's a gentle murmur. Soon we'll have to move out of the way of some stampeding double basses. Two of the orchestra players, cellist Michael Atkinson and Martin Owen, have very kindly, principal horn Martin Owen, have kindly sort of stood to one side with me just before they head in for Tippett's Second Symphony, which we will be hearing in just a few moments. But I just wanted to start, Michael, with asking you, when this was premiered, this piece, one of the string players took a few liberties, we might say, sort of tried to improve on Tippett's string writing. Maybe not the best idea, but this is a very difficult play for the strings, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's very busy. There are a lot of notes per minute, and they're not necessarily the notes you're expecting. So they're not necessarily in the order that you're expecting to be. So you're having to remain concentrated for the whole time.
No let up. Martin, do you get an easier time of it on the horns?
Barely easier, actually. I have to say it's quite a challenging work for the horns. And just a couple of years before he wrote this Second Symphony, Tippett wrote a sonata for four horns, which was very virtuosic, partly because there was a wonderful horn player called Dennis Brain around at the time, and he wanted to really utilise his skill. And by the time the Fourth Symphony was written, Tippett really put in a lot of that kind of virtuosity into his work. So it's an incredibly difficult piece.
You mentioned the Fourth Symphony there. Earlier on in the year, you took on the whole cycle. The orchestra played the full four symphony cycle of Tippett's symphonies. How does this stand for you in amongst the four, this second one for you, Michael?
For me, it's an interesting piece because it's almost purely purely musical, the interest in it. When you get to the Third Symphony, it's much more political and social animal. But the Second Symphony is much more purely musical, inspired by Vivaldi and Bach.
Ah, yes, you mentioned Vivaldi, and Tippett did say that he had been sort of gazing at a lake and he drew inspiration when he heard, I think, Vivaldi on the radio, some crashing cellos in their bass line. Do you feel that inspiration when you're playing it, both of you? Can you feel Vivaldi coursing through?
You do, yes. But as a horn player, I have a slightly different role in the symphony. Whereas the strings, they start with this beautiful C ground bass notes that they want to continue through the piece, particularly through the first movement. The horns, however, they want to ruin the party, rather.
Oh, so, no, never.
Well, it's never been done before, I'm sure. So they come crashing in a different key, which is intentional, by the way. And I think there are various stories about the very first performance of this piece, but whatever actually happened, it only stopped when the horns came in.
The horns come crashing in. I've never heard anything like it. Michael is casting rueful looks at his colleague, Martin Owen. Gentlemen, I will let you take your places back with your orchestra. Thank you so much for taking the time to catch up with us. Good luck. Back to you, Martin.
Thanks so much, Georgia. Georgia Mann down in the Bull Run here at the Royal Albert Hall with Principal Horn, Martin Owen, and cellist Michael Atkinson. As Georgia said, the BBC Symphony Orchestra has been exploring Tippett's orchestral music throughout this past season. And judging by the very respectable size of the audience at the audiences at the Barbican, and again indeed tonight for this prom, I'm not the only one who feels that Tippett has been neglected since his death 15 years ago. This season's proms are also going some way towards giving Tippett his due by programming seven of his works, the first of them his Second Symphony, which we'll hear in a couple of minutes' time. Conductor Oliver Nusson believes this symphony came at a crucial moment in Tippett's career, commissioned as it was by the BBC to mark the 10th anniversary of the third programme in 1957.
It's a piece that's at the sort of fulcrum of his life, it comes just after the period of the Midsummer Marriage and the Piano Concerto and these incredible pieces with millions of notes and this wonderful sort of Englishness and magical atmosphere. And there is a lot of that in it. But on the other side, the next pieces that he was to write, the opera King Priam and the Second Piano Sonata and the Concerto for Orchestra, were much more austere music made in blocks, also very expressive and full of beautiful things, but a very different kind of continuity. And this piece miraculously has both worlds together. It's like the twilight of one and the dawning of another. For example, the slow movement of this piece consists of two or three different types of melodic statement. The movement ends by simply cutting them into pieces, and that's very characteristic of the later Tippett. The first movement grew from him hearing some recordings of Vivaldi, and that's obviously the trigger that made this tremendously athletic first movement take off. But there's a good deal of magic Midsummer Marriage music in that movement too. The scherzo used to be very famous among student conductors because it changes meter a great deal. The climax of the movement is really an orgy of cross-cutting between different types of additive bars. But in fact, it's a very nice, very charming movement, actually. And the last movement relates also back to a sort of English magic world, which is the Purcell Fantasias. It's a chain, as the Purcell Fantasias, also some of them are. It's a chain of different kinds of music, but this, in this case, just stated one after the other, the last one of which is the returning of the pounding Vivaldi seas, which has as much right to be there as anything else in the movement.
Tonight's conductor, Oliver Nussen. Well, it was a very big stage move, the orchestra coming back now gradually onto the platform, but gives us time to hear from Tippett himself, talking in 1960, soon after he completed his Second Symphony, when he spoke about what was expected of artists at the time.
I know that there's a great deal of, at present moment, of preoccupation, or pattern preoccupation, of composers and other artists in purely technical terms. They, as it were, want to abstract all the human emotions apparently and produce an art which is so down to the rock bottom basis, and in the case of visual art, absolutely quite abstract. I'm desperately involved in the whole problem of what human beings are suffering at this time in an incoherent world, how they find any kinds of living pattern. I'm much closer in that sense to novelists than I would be to very abstract kinds of things. And yet I could not but know that the problems of abstracting something, of making limits within which you can speak, are absolute for the art. You can't have an artistic thing at all unless you have somewhere limited things and made a form.
Michael Tippett talking in 1960. Well, the Albert Hall platform is finally filling up with the full BBC Symphony Orchestra for the finale, as it were, of tonight's concert, from the intimate Takamitsu with Peter Serkin to Michael Tippett's Second Symphony. Getting to know Beethoven's work was a deep and essential musical experience for Tippett, and his Second Symphony has a Beethovenian ground plan, really, as well as those influences from the Baroque that Oliver Nussen was talking about. He wrote the symphony a few years after his opera A Midsummer Marriage, which you can hear at the Proms in a couple of weeks or so. And as Oliver Nussen was saying, there are echoes of Midsummer Marriage's otherworldly magic. In fact, you can hear the Midsummer Marriage complete in the Prom on Friday the 16th of August, starting at 6:30. Live, of course, here on the home of BBC Proms, Radio 3. And again, as Georgia was talking to the two players from the orchestra about Tippett, had an exact moment of first inspiration for the symphony. It was about the time he was completing Midsummer Marriage. He was sitting in a studio, apparently, at Radio Lugano, looking out over the sunlit lake and listening to tapes of Vivaldi. And he said it was that pounding bass line which threw him from Vivaldi's world into his own and marked the exact moment of conception of the symphony. I should explain to you what's going on here. There's Oliver Nussen very particular about where he seats people on the Albert Hall stage. And in order to get the trumpets down on a lower level with the upper wind, in fact, if you can imagine the steps up at the back of the Albert Hall stage, there on the lowest level, together with the flutes and oboes. But in order to get them there with the trombones and tuba behind them means that the double basses are somewhat crammed into the bull run and round the edge of the stage. And this is part of what's taking time now, and also to make sure that the basses are fully protected from the trumpets just behind them. The plastic screens are now being put into place. And as well as that, of course, as all the BBC microphones having to be adjusted, a lot of that having to go on between each piece tonight. So Jan Fischer, as you can hear, is now tuning BBC Symphony Orchestra. I talked about Midsummer Marriage, but that's not actually the first work of Tippett's that will follow this symphony here at the Proms. In the 3 o'clock matinee at Cadogan Hall this coming Saturday, with the Britten Sinfonia conducted by Sean Edwards, they'll be playing the Fantasia Concertante on a theme of Corelli, as well as music by Lennox Barclay, Hulst, the St Paul's Suite, and Britten, indeed. Britten's Phaedra ends the programme. That's on Saturday, 3 o'clock at Cadogan Hall. And now here once again is Oliver Nussen joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall to perform Tippett's Second Symphony. The glowing ending of Tippett's Second Symphony, underpinned by those pounding bass notes he first heard in the Vivaldi Concerto, and which had been his original inspiration. The symphony's been performed here at the Royal Albert Hall to end this BBC Prom, live here on Radio 3 by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, guest leader Jan Fischer, conducted by the orchestra's artist in association, Oliver Nassen. Don't forget The Midsummer Marriage, performed on the 16th of August by tonight's orchestra with soloists and chorus, conducted by Sir Andrew Davis. The next Tippett at the Prom Saturday afternoon, the 3 o'clock matinee at Cadogan Hall, the Britten Sinfonia and Sean Edwards, the Fantasia Concertante on a theme of Corelli, as well as music by Leonard Sparkley, Holst and Britten. As for Oliver Nassen, I asked him what he's up to next. He said composing. Wouldn't be led into what? Sadly. Then he's got concerts with the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group and the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, when he'll be premiering a new piece by Sir Peter Maxwell Davis, Max. And the principal trumpet, guest trumpet of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Alan Harrell, brought to his feet. Alan Bolam, principal trombone, wonderful solos throughout, bringing up all the wind section. Figure of Oliver Nassen, who reigned magisterially over the concert this evening, I would say. Well, I played the Concerto for Double String Orchestra with Michael Tippett as conductor as a teenager in the mid-60s. He galvanised us by treating us as proper musicians and made a disarming speech to the audience, saying it was a good thing for young people to play music that was less obvious than the Tchaikovsky Symphony we were going to perform after the interval. Perhaps, he said, even Tippett now and then. A bit more than now and then, I think. Well, tomorrow evening at 7:30, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra with its principal conductor, Peter Unjun, in his Proms debut, make their contribution to the BBC Proms Tchaikovsky Symphony Cycle with the wonderful fifth, Tchaik at his best. Oliver Nassen waving the score of Tippett's Second Symphony. Rachmaninoff, the third piano concerto with Nikolai Lugansky in a mammoth three-part prom. First, third, world premiere, Naresh Sohal's The Cosmic Dance. Another fascinating evening down here at the Royal Albert Hall. But for now, time for me to hand you on to Ian Skelly in the cool glades of Broadcasting House to guide you through the rest of your Radio 3 evening. Ian.
Martin, thank you. Yes, an Arctic scene here by comparison to the Kalahari-like conditions at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. That was Martin Handley sweating it out for us live at the Proms. Prom number 26 as we head towards the end of the third week of the BBC Proms. It's already produced fantastically exciting performances. Too many to list, really, when I think back to all we've heard so far, and so much more to come. Well, if you didn't catch all of tonight's Prom you have access to the internet, then do visit the Radio 3 website and listen to it again online anytime you'd like to over the next 7 days. And there are plenty of other Proms to listen to and watch on the iPlayer, including our lunchtime recitals, which take place during the Proms from Cadogan Hall every Monday lunchtime here on Radio 3. This year, as well as our microphones, Radio 3 has had cameras there, so you can watch the recitals online as well as listen to them. Well, what of the rest of tonight on Radio 3? In a moment, we're going to take a look at how crowd control has become a growing science. And then in our essay, we go back to before nonsense poetry was invented and discover why it suddenly emerged from the pens of the likes of Edward Lear. It somehow fitted with Victorian society, as you'll hear at 10:45. And Fiona Talkington will be here later tonight with more recordings from the WOMAD Festival last weekend at Charlton Park in Wiltshire. Late Junction begins at 11 tonight. Here on Radio 3.
Wagner's Tannhäuser at the BBC Proms. Continuing this season's anniversary focus on the music of Richard Wagner, the tale of a troubadour who yearns for spiritual redemption, the woman who loves him, and the man who loves her. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and conductor Donald Runicles continue their acclaimed Wagner partnership at the BBC Proms. Sunday night from 6 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM on digital radio and in high-definition sound online. Just after 10 o'clock now. And next tonight, one of our summer series of Radio 3 feature documentaries. Professor Steve Jones begins a journey with two political thinkers over 100 years apart in crowd psychology.
These are sickening scenes. Scenes of people looting, vandalising, thieving, robbing. Scenes of people attacking police officers. This is criminality, pure and simple, and it has to be confronted and defeated.
It's not just his own behaviour that makes someone caught up in a crowd act differently. In the end, he loses his capacity to think as an individual. On the way, his whole personality changes, from being rational to being mindless, from coward into hero, and from honesty to criminal.
One of those statements was written a year ago, the other in 1896. The sentiments are much the same. Which is which? And another clue. One is by a Frenchman and the other by an Englishman. And as a final hint, both of them moved in high political circles. Well, if the suspense is too much, the first is from a speech made by David Cameron after the riots that rocked these islands just a year ago. While the other is from a book entitled The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind, by the 19th century French political thinker Gustave Le Bon. Alarmed by the ongoing disturbances in his capital city, he set out to give the mindless mob a mind of its own.
The fact that they have been transformed into a crowd puts them in possession of a sort of collective mind, which makes them feel, think, and act in a manner quite different from that in which each individual of them would feel.
When it comes to mobs, or so it seems, not much has changed, at least from the politician's point of view. But that's not true. Science has got into the act and, as it always does, has begun to replace opinions with facts. In Three's a Crowd, we ask, what is a crowd? How do people respond to being surrounded by thousands of others? The question is important to politicians and policemen, but also to architects, to firefighters and to theatre designers. And what can crowds, angry or happy, calm or frightened, tell us about ourselves as individuals? It's worth remembering that everyone listening to this programme probably encountered more people on this single day than the average person over human history, and that's a hunter-gatherer on the plains of Africa, saw in his whole lifetime. For most of us, two's company, but what makes a crowd? Gustave Le Bon.
Crowds display an inferior mentality. Because of their destructive power, they act like the bacteria which attack a weakened body. They have all kinds of special characteristics. They include impulsiveness, irritability, an inability to make reasoned judgments or accept criticism, exaggerated feelings, and many more.
Powerful stuff, but how well does it stand up? Professor Steve Reicher from the University of St Andrews, author of Mad Mobs and Englishmen.
Crowd psychology really arose in the 19th century, in the period of industrialisation, where previously disparate populations who were dispersed in small villages came together, became massed in the towns, and they became a great object of fear. The real concern of the dominant groups in society was, you know, what would happen with these people? Could we keep them under control? Would they get together and overthrow the public order? So in many ways, crowd psychology grew out of a fear of the mass, and much of what was said came from this elite fear of the power of what we sometimes call the dangerous classes. Now, the classic notion, which was best expressed by a French psychologist called Gustave Le Bon, whose book on the crowd has been described as the most influential psychology text of all time, not only did it describe, but it helped form the mass politics of the 20th and 21st century.
19th century France figures large in the story of the crowd.
Historian and psychoanalyst Daniel Pick.
Gustave Le Bon, who becomes the most popular writer on the crowd in the late 19th century, argues that a crowd does have a psychology of its own that is irreducible to the psychologies of its individual participants, and that and for Le Bon, the key thing is that governments and elites understand this beast and understand the way it functions as though it's a kind of collective mind.
So what was his view of this beast? Presumably it was a feral beast that had to be tamed.
Yes, that either it would be tamed or it would overthrow civilization. And I think for Le Bon, there's a kind of idea here also of national psychology, of national characters, and of different levels of civilization. So a sort of notion that the European powers are the pinnacle of civilization and more advanced in evolutionary terms, but are threatened always for him by this potential collapse back into anarchy.
So it's a step down the evolutionary tree, really, a crowd.
Yeah, and theories of evolution and theories of civilization and progress are inextricably linked, I think. Enormously sort of patrician disdain for the ordinary people and the crowd.
There's nothing like that around nowadays, surely.
Well, I think it has all sorts of echoes and resonances. One wouldn't have to scratch very far beneath the surface to see that kind of patrician contempt.
Ah, yes, patrician contempt. There's nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. But to a scientist, or even to a social scientist, that's not enough. We need to look objectively at the mass if there's to be any hope of understanding what sparks off a riot, leads to panic in a burning building, or even allows us to make our way through a crowded street without ending up in a bad-tempered traffic jam. Nowadays, the study of crowds is based not on rhetoric, but on research. It began with the Kerner Report that followed the Martin Luther King riots in 1968. The results were quite unexpected. The mob, which had raged through more than 100 cities and had caused dozens of deaths, was not simply a series of criminals led by agitators, but something quite different. Steve Riker.
The urban riots in the United States of the 1960s led to one of the greatest pieces of research that was ever done, the most extensive pieces of research that was ever done into what people do in crowds, the Kerner Commission. And it showed a number of things. The first thing it showed was that participants, on the whole, were not on the margins of society. They weren't the riffraff that we're often told they were. They tended to be more integrated into the communities. The second myth that it debunked was that people just attacked anything. And one of the people involved in the report made this remarkable statement. He said the riots were chiefly notable for their restraint. He didn't mean by that there was no violence. There was huge violence, far greater than in the UK in 2011. But the point was there was a pattern, not just anything was attacked. And the third myth that he debunked was the agitator theory, the notion that there's a hidden hand, that somebody is directing this, either anarchists or leftists or some sort of troublemaker. And again, they could find absolutely no evidence for this at all. Now, fast forward to 2011, you find all those arguments being made all over again. Who took part? Well, we're told that those at the bottom of society, those who haven't developed morality, they were the problem. The second argument that we hear is this argument of the explosion of the mob, of everything and anything getting attacked. And again, when you look closely, especially at the early riots, the Tottenham riot, you find very clear patterns to what's attacked. And in terms of agitators, right at the beginning, the claim was it was gangs who were mobilising it, gangs who were organising it. And very quickly, the government had to back off and say, well, perhaps there isn't as much evidence as we thought of gang involvement. So the classic myths are as mythical in 2011 as ever they were.
People should be in no doubt that we will do everything necessary to restore order to Britain's streets and to make them safe for the law-abiding.
Well, I'm standing in Oxford Street, which is a pretty crowded kind of place, and our preconceptions about such things, about crowds, at least when things go wrong, do seem to be pretty imprecise. Far from the crowd only having a mind of its own, as the Frenchman Le Bon insisted, the crucial thing may be the individual minds of those who belong to them. So how do scientists define a crowd? In fact, I'm not alone in the midst of this great crowd of people. I'm with John Drury, a social psychologist at the University of Sussex. John, here in Oxford Street, I find myself pretty calm, but you seem less than calm. Why is that?
Like many people, I found the tube coming here today a deeply unpleasant experience.
I too find crowds fairly unpleasant, but I've lived in London. I've lived in London all my life. You see, I don't find this crowded.
Which is interesting, because sometimes I, like other people, really enjoy the crowd. But then how does that square? How does that square with our experience? Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant, and sometimes we actually seek it out. So to make sense of that, we have to have a conception of the crowd. What do we mean by the crowd? Now, one understanding is it's simply people who are physically together, okay? But the same density can produce these differing effects, so there has to be something else, something psychological. And it's the way that people define themselves. Do they define themselves in terms of their personal identity, where they see all those around them as individuals with different identities and different interests and so on? Or do they define themselves as psychological, part of a group, where they don't experience others' presence as an intrusion in their personal space, but they actually welcome it as enhancing their experience?
Okay, so you're on the tube, yeah. You're surrounded by deeply unpleasant people who think you're unpleasant. You certainly don't feel part of a joint experience.
Yeah.
Do you need to build that into your definition of what's a crowd?
Well, yeah, that is a physical crowd. That is a physical crowd. But it changes, of course, when the train breaks down. When the train breaks down, we all feel a common sense of a grievance with the train company, and we all sit around and complain and talk about it. These things shift and change. So it's not the physical properties, it's the psychological properties of that situation that define whether it's unpleasant or pleasant.
Oxford Street is pretty crowded today, but in just a month, it'll be really packed. 5 miles to the east, we'll have John Drury's nightmare.
The International Olympic Committee has the honour of announcing that the Games of the 30th Olympiad in 2012 are awarded to the city of London.
In a month, the Olympics will come to London for the third time, 1908, 1948, and now 2012. The 1948 event was held in the old Wembley Stadium, now demolished and replaced by a spanking new structure designed by the architect Tom Jones, who works in a practice called Populus. That's Populus with a U, which means, of course, lots of people. He's recently completed an even more high-profile project.
Well, this is a model of the London Olympic Stadium. It's built in two halves so that we can sort of take them apart and allows people to get down at eye level and get a sense of what it would be like standing at the track, looking up at the seating tiers and the roof. The model also encompasses the stadium island site itself, because one of the unique characteristics of the Olympic Stadium is that it's set on an island. You can probably see the river running around on both sides of the stadium.
One obvious difference between this and the previous Olympic Stadium, the old Wembley Stadium, is seats. Why seats?
The UK has had a series of stadium disasters in the sort of 80s and 90s, related to things like fires, obviously the terrible crushing incident at Hillsborough, Ibrox in Glasgow had the sort of terrible crushing of people down staircases. And the move recently has been to move away from standing areas of terrace to all-seater stadia. And that was really driven by the Taylor Report into how to overcome some of these tragedies. And one of its key conclusions was that by providing stadia with seats everywhere has sort of broken down those large areas of open standing area where the crowds used to sway and move backwards and forwards into the sides, obviously into an individual seat.
So we don't really have a football crowd anymore. We've got a lot of football individuals.
Yes, I guess in some ways. And, you know, there's a debate within football about, you know, whether we should be looking to go back to some version of standing areas.
So we need to say something about why it is sometimes crowds are very attractive and sometimes crowds are the most unattractive things imaginable.
How much of this do you reckon is built into human biology? I mean, you know, one of the worst tortures, and I use the word advisedly, you can apply to anybody is to put them in solitary confinement, which the US widely does now, of course. But of course, for a solitary primate, like an orangutan, the worst torture would be to go to a dinner party. Yeah. So is it
well,
the case...
Well, parties can be torture for some of us as well. Isn't it the same point again? Of course, what we're talking about is the meanings, OK? It's the meaning of the people who are around you. Their identities, how you see them, that determines whether you find that heaven or find it hell. Because sometimes I actually seek out the crowd. I mean, think of music, for example. Why is it that people go to concerts, they go to festivals? Festivals are massive now. They have that inconvenience, all these queues and things. Why don't they simply sit at home and listen to their CDs? So there's something that the crowd gives you.
So, it all depends on whether you're angry or calm, excited or bored. But you can manipulate the mood of a crowd easily enough if you know what you're doing. The impresario Diaghilev certainly knew what he was doing on a now infamous Parisian night in 1913 at the premiere of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Musicologist Leslie Chamberlain.
Certainly there was a kind of riot. I think as soon as the curtain went up, there was scuffling and shouting and booing and so on. And I think more recently, people begin to dig underneath the surface, and they found out that probably it was organised and that Diaghilev had got hold of supporters and people who would quarrel over this event and got them to come into the theatre. In fact, he even put a notice in a newspaper saying it was bound to be an occasion for passionate differences. And so he managed to get a lot of people in the theatre who were bound to disagree. And in fact, they started disagreeing almost on cue when the curtain went up. So looking at that, I mean, it puts a different complexion on how that audience was actually being rather manipulated.
So it's actually a manipulated crowd in some ways. He knew that if he had enough people together, he'd say he could have a riot.
I think so, and I think there's quite a long history of that. There's something called the clack, which was kind of the origins of rent-a-crowd. It used to have a more polite name, and the first clack was around in France, believe it or not, in the 16th century. And this practice of getting people to take their places in the theatre who were bound to shout and encourage support for a production, that was the clack. And it grew and it grew and it grew. And by the 19th century, there were actually organisations that were providing clacks. You could go and buy a clack if you were putting on your first night to make sure that you had a lot of support in the audience.
So how would they demonstrate the support? Would it just be clapping or shouting? Or?
Clapping, trying to work on the emotions of other people in the audience. So giving the lead to crying or shouting or laughing. I mean, it's probably very difficult to tell the difference between what is spontaneous and what isn't. And that goes back to the first night of the Rite of Spring and why it's only coming out now that it might have been in some way organised and orchestrated, the reaction and the clash.
Well, that's the conscious management of crowd psychology, the stuff that Le Bon and Cameron were so concerned about, agitators coming in and whipping the mass into a frenzy. But there's a more subtle form of consciousness in every large group of people which gives the crowd a personality it doesn't know it has. The Rite of Spring has been much analysed by musicologists, but physicists and experts on crowds are just as interested in the applause. When two pendulums swing from an elastic cord, the energy from one passes into the other and can cause each to tick in synchrony. That's what science calls a coupled oscillator. Sometimes, though, the system cycles back and forth as each component competes for dominance, or it can behave chaotically or even come to a dead stop. The same thing happens in the theatre or the concert hall. As the crowd, the audience, begins to act in consort to show its appreciation, some surprising regularities can build up. Zoltán Neder is a theoretical physicist at Babes Bolyai University in Romania. He's an expert on the behaviour of tiny particles as they interact with each other, which is, after all, what all of us are when we're cheering on the performers.
The interesting point is that the audience wants, in fact, two things. Wants, first of all, to reward the artist with a strong clapping intensity, so strong noise intensity in the room. This is a sign that they like the performance. Also, they have learned a trick, that it is a natural tendency to make a kind of rhythmic applause. But the interesting thing is that they cannot achieve these two aims in the same clapping mode. And this frustration which exists between these two tendencies to achieve both the noise intensity high and rhythmicity in the clapping is doing that the system goes consecutively between synchronized, unsynchronized, synchronized, and unsynchronized clapping regimes. And this is the global behavior which is rising from the individual's behavior of shifting between these two clapping modes, the fast and the slow clapping mode.
So you've basically got a cyclical system, really.
Exactly.
It's a bit like the stock market, boom followed by slump.
Very, very, very similar.
But, I mean, in some ways, you're rejecting any interest in the psychology, the physiology of individuals. They're, to you, as a statistical physicist, they're just like atoms or a gas molecule or something like that. Is that true?
Exactly. This is probably the education I got. Also, nice thing in this one, that this is a spontaneous behavior. So it's nobody driving it. So there is no single conductor who says that, okay, I'm the leader and follow me. So the system agrees upon a common rhythm. And this is very different from what we have learned in the communist regime, when there was this kind of rhythmic applause going on for 20 minutes and the rhythmic applause was constant. It never shifted to the thunderous clapping. Because there, in fact, there were some conductors. There were the so-called propaganda people who were making this kind of rhythm in the system, and that was not a spontaneous applause. That was very clearly, it can be seen, it was a driven applause. So it was a conductor who was dictating the rhythm there.
So it was a performance in its own right in some ways.
Exactly.
So even when there's nobody in control, the audience choreographs itself and begins, without realizing it, to act as one. And the ability to pick that up, to control the coupled oscillator of shared opinion, is central to the art of the demagogue, or perhaps to that of any politician. Le Bon thought he understood that well enough. The flighty and supposedly feminine nature of crowds is what made them so easy to manipulate. Some major political figures took his advice. In his new book, Pursuit of the Nazi Mind, Hitler, Hesse and the Analysts, Daniel Pick has tracked down some very sinister followers of that French thinker.
Le Bon's ideas lent themselves very well to thinkers of the right. What the fascist ideologues in the interwar period endorse and, in a way, powerfully then shape is the belief that what societies need are powerful dictatorial figures, a great individual will who will master the crowd. So for them, democracy brings chaos. And what you really need is a strong man, the figure of the Duce or the Führer, of a very powerful figure who can dominate and master the crowd, in a way obedient to the supreme will of the leader. And it's choreographed dramatically by Leni Riefenstahl in her notorious film, The Triumph of the Will.
The Le Bonian notion was what happens in the crowd is we lose our conscious personalities, our individual sense of self. And because the individual sense of self is where our values, our standards are located, if you lose yourself, we revert, we go back to a more primitive state. He said people in crowd are barbarians. We descend several rungs on the ladder of civilization.
When you dissect what happened in the streets of London and other cities not so long ago, the responses are exactly that. They're evolutionary responses. This is a rabble. They're a lower form of life.
Absolutely. You see, the Le Bonian notion famously noted that the behavioural characteristics of crowds, their emotionality, their fickleness, their inability to reason, are reminiscent of inferior forms of humanity, women and savages. So there's a great psychologist managed to get racism and sexism into a single paragraph.
So a theory about female psychology that was itself full of prejudices and stereotypical thinking and misogyny, really, was grafted into a theory of the crowd, that it was fickle, that it was hysterical, that it was malleable, nervous. And later you find this notion of the femininity of the crowd being re-expressed by Hitler in Mein Kampf. And of course, there's a debate later on about whether Mussolini and Hitler have read any of this crowd literature, but certainly they know of it at second hand.
We know for certain that Mussolini and Le Bon exchanged letters, that Mussolini was a reader and an admirer of Le Bon. He said so in a letter that Le Bon published in his last work. The larger point is that he had enormous impact in his lifetime, and he dined with prime ministers. His book on the crowd was required reading at the École de Guerre in France, at the French War College.
So a rather uncanny link between 19th century philosophy and 20th century history.
That's right, and it went beyond dictators. Teddy Roosevelt said that Le Bon was a major influence upon him.
An American in Paris, Gregory Scheer, professor of history at the College of Worcester in Ohio, reminding us of the lasting influence of Gustave Le Bon. Most of that author's writings are subjective and even slightly hysterical, and they're based on opinions rather than on facts. After the collapse of the German and Italian dictatorships, which grew in part from his teachings, science began at last to get into the act. The Nobel-winning novelist Elias Canetti actually had a degree in chemistry from the University of Vienna. As a Jewish exile in England, before and during the Second World War, he observed with horror the triumph of the demagogues. In his 1960 book, Crowds and Power, he turned his scientists' and his novelists' eyes upon what had driven those terrifying masses. Leslie Chamberlain.
He was a Jew. He was born in Bulgaria. He moved with his mother to England before the war, and I'm sure he had his focus absolutely on what was happening in Germany. And then he started writing this study of crowds and power. And one of the things that he noticed was that rhythm was absolutely essential to the crowd. And he talked on another occasion of the crowd being like wind. And you can kind of see that visually, but you can also almost hear it.
So the crowd behaviour is almost like meteorology, like physics.
That was one of his analogies.
And that idea of people as no more than interacting particles can work pretty well in practice. One of the great worries about crowds is that they can fall into an irrational state in which their behaviour becomes threatening or even lethal. Once again, that has a reflection in architecture. Le Bon's native city, Paris, has great boulevards that crisscross the centre. Unlike London, which is a rapid one, a mess. The reason? The mob. The riots of 1848, which killed thousands and led to Baron Haussmann's great wide streets, designed for moving troops and as free fire zones. They were very useful during the next uprising, the 1870 Commune, which led to the death of 20,000 rioters in a single week. No wonder Le Bon had doubts about the masses getting out of control. And today's architects still worry about that. The Olympic Stadium may have been designed to remove the risk of the deadly stadium panics of 20 years ago, but its architect, like all his colleagues, has to plan how to get people to safety quickly and calmly if something terrible does go wrong. Tom Jones, whose practice designed the stadium, has a series of computer models that reveal how to do that job. At least in part, they treat people as particles, with no more personality than a carbon atom. And, up to a point, that works well.
So what I'm playing for you now is an animation of dynamic modelling on the Olympic Stadium. And in particular, this is the case of an emergency evacuation. And the colours of all the dots represent spectators from different parts of the stadium.
And each of those spots, or pixels, I guess they're called, each of those spots is a single individual.
That's right. There's 80,000 dots that represent all the people that will be in the stadium.
80,000 people. And you have to empty it?
We have to get everybody out of the stadium bowl within 8 minutes.
So you need to get 1,000 people a minute out of the stadium. That's quite a challenge.
No, it is. And what you'll see here is that mixing of the yellow, blue, green, pink and purple dots, which means that all of the different spectators are exiting from the stadium and heading for one each of the five bridges on the island. And what it does is it allows us to identify hotspots where there may be greater congestion.
This looks a bit like the models that physicists use to look at the flow of water through a tube or oil through a pipeline, Reynolds numbers and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Is this basically physics, or is there some human sciences in there too, some psychology?
I think it starts off as physics because we have sort of fixed widths of stairs and doors. On the island, we obviously have a fixed perimeter of the site itself. And when we get to pinch points like bridges, that obviously is a fixed point as well. So I think at that point, your physics analogy is probably closest. However, what the dynamic modelling does allow us to do is to give parameters to the pixels to represent people's reaction to different levels of crowding.
I mean, some of them are doing some slightly odd stuff. They seem to be running back into the stadium almost.
It is interesting, actually, that there are times when the model has been run where we've seen odd individual pixels going in directions that make no sense whatsoever. So I think there.
So it's a good model.
It does allow for that individuality.
Yes, well, people as particles, but that must miss something. For at least as far as we know, atoms don't feel joy, anger, or even embarrassment, which certainly alters our own behaviour to the person next door. At Princeton University, Andrew Gallup has been looking at the way in which people react to each other's presence when they're packed together.
When someone is walking towards you, that presents the opportunity to interact with them. And in crowded urban settings, most of the pedestrians, the vast majority of pedestrians that you're encountering are strangers. And in these natural settings, social psychologists have demonstrated that when there's the possibility of social interaction with strangers, it's usually avoided in most cases, particularly in close proximity. And we've demonstrated within a 2-meter range that when oncoming pedestrians avert their looking behavior,